Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Do you remember a day before email, smartphones, text messaging, Facebook, or Twitter? Today we live in a day of constant connectivity where we're never without a chat, technology, or an electronic stimulus. This is profoundly changing our neuroscience, our interpersonal relationships, our societal roles, even our etiquette. My guest today ponders and examines the role constant connectivity has on our daily lives in his book, The End of Absence, Reclaiming What We've Lost in a World of Constant Connection. Michael Harris says our current age compares to the social upheavals caused by the invention of Gutenberg's printing press. But the influence of our technology today is manifesting itself in the course of a few years, as opposed to a century or more in Gutenberg's age. Michael Harris is a acclaimed journalist and a contributing editor at Western Living and Vancouver magazines. And during the course of his research for The End of Absence, he actually spent a month without digital media. He calls it his analog August. And he challenges listeners to, if not take a month, take at least a weekend without digital media to see the difference it makes in our lives. Michael Harris is our guest today. Michael Harris, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
In your book, The End of Absence, you depict this particular time as a time where we're undergoing some of the biggest societal changes since Gutenberg's printing press 550 years ago. Give us a sense of how big the changes were then, and how would you compare them to today?
Well, the biggest difference between the two things would be that although they both radically transformed the way we see the world and the way we see ourselves, Gutenberg's printing press, the effects of that machine rolled out over centuries, really, right? Mm-hmm. It was invented in 1450, but it wasn't until the 19th century that most people were literate. So you really had a long time for society to catch up to what was, in the end, a really radical change. Meanwhile, today, we've had about 20 years of the internet, and radically transformed our lives within a single generation. So that was really one of the impetuses for writing this, was I wanted to look at how does it feel to live through a Gutenberg moment of our own, and to actually be one of these people. I'm 34 years old, so I'm one of these people who still has memories of life before the internet.
What did you say the year of birth had to be a complete digital native, somebody who's never not known the internet and technology as the way we know it today as a part of their lives?
Well, the number I quoted in the book is 1985. Mm-hmm. I said, if you were born after 1985, then you probably have never really been an adult without the internet. But, of course, choosing exactly that date is a bit of a parlor game, but that's where I drew the line.
Now, one of the things I found really interesting is when you went back and looked at how the printing press had a societal effect, and it had major societal effects. I mean, you're talking about whole occupations gone. And what was really interesting was the really true great thinkers, as soon as they saw this, they said, this means the end of that. I think that's a French quote.
This
kills that.
Yeah.
People were aware. Whether it's the idea of one-way religion, that the authorities are going to tell you what to believe, the beauty of Notre Dame to explain the glories of religion, the Bible, that printed Bible, changed all of that.
It reorganizes whole monopolies of knowledge, and by doing that, it reorganizes power structures too, right? Because the more people who have printed knowledge, the more unstable those power structures become. So you're right. Every time there's a new communication revolution, all the way back to the invention of writing or the invention of papyrus, every time there have been people who have pointed out that this kills that, that the new technology wipes out a way of life. That doesn't mean that we have to grouse about it, though. I think the key is to be optimistically critical, so that we can notice there's massive change going on and figure out what do we want to save from the old way of life and bring into our new world.
Struck by something you said, you referred to how the printing press reorganized the monopoly of knowledge. And that's really what we have going on right now.
You can definitely argue that, yeah.
Yeah. And the power that that monopoly of information gives one has been weakened by the internet. You just have to look at WikiLeaks and things like that from a political power standpoint. But the whole idea of, I think, what was it, you quote somebody involved with the Encyclopedia Britannica and said, you know, when they saw the internet and go, well, or Wikipedia said, well, this is going to be a completely different ballgame.
Yeah, I think the quote was actually, I guess we have to accept that the world will soon be run by people less intelligent than ourselves. I'm not sure I'm that pessimistic, but, you know, you can see where the guy is coming from. It is a movement away from elite keepers of knowledge and toward a democratic system, which sounds good, but definitely has its perils, too. If you crowdsource all information, there's going to be problems that come up.
You interviewed for the book a gentleman who is a Wikipedia, what do they call them, public editors or?
Yeah, there's an interesting thing. They don't like having anybody named as having more power than anyone else, but there are quasi-administrators sort of floating around. And this guy, James Hailman, he's a doctor in British Columbia.
And in his case, he was trying to get a dubious mention of transcendental meditation removed.
Yeah,
and it gets a sense of, he said, this is absolutely wrong information. And yet the democratic side of Wikipedia, enough devotees of TM, basically kept that erroneous information from being excised.
Yeah, and there is a higher court of last, what do they call it, court of last refusal or something, that you can go to where you can kind of plead your case. And unfortunately, the only thing that they can judge is behavior. They don't judge based on truth. So as long as the transcendental meditation lobby was playing by the rules, it didn't matter whether there was no actual scientific proof for what they were arguing. And that it's an interesting point, because while Encyclopedia Britannica had errors in it, and we know that, they were errors of human failing. They weren't manipulative errors. And what I worry about is a future where not just something like TM can persuade us toward things, but what happens when large corporations over the course of centuries slowly nudge the truth in their own favor?
Yeah, no, it's a very good point. Whether it's large corporations or whatever power structures, governments, anything.
Mm.
Yeah,
absolutely.
I mean, that's this kind of scary thing about it, in which a crowdsourced world, behavior counts more than truth and facts.
Exactly. And just because, I mean, in the same way that, you know, corporations in the United States are treated as legal persons, that democratic truth project that Wikipedia is endeavoring to accomplish, part of that demos, part of that public body, is a corporate body. So we do have to be aware that they're part of the project.
Now, one of the things you did was examine how already this 20 years of internet society has changed us. In what ways has it changed us? I mean, you tell the story of 1 and 2 year old children who look at a cover of a glossy magazine and instinctively do the little pinch to zoom in or zoom out. That kind of blows my mind. but give us a sense of how it's actually changed us and how we view reality.
Well, I mean, in my book, In the End of Absence, the thing I'm focusing on is those qualities of solitude, reverie, daydreaming that have been stripped from our lives through the course of being constantly connected. So for myself, the thing I notice is we've become terrified of being alone. We actually have become very uncomfortable with absence. And I think it's because, you know, it's part of being human that we desire social connection, and our technologies become very good at capitalizing on that desire.
One of the things I found interesting was you recount a story, which then you followed up with some research from people who are studying this. You mentioned a exchange on a bus, I believe it was. Two 16-year-old boys, you know, one was already on the bus, another one comes on the bus, and he sort of gives them a little sup, what's up, you know, head nod.
Yeah.
But they don't sit together.
Yeah.
And then they immediately start texting one another instead of going back and sitting together and talking.
And, yeah, they were sitting 3 feet apart from each other, and it was obvious by, you know, sort of covertly watching them that's what they were doing, that they were sending texts back and forth. And they'd occasionally kind of send a shy smile to each other. And that scene, you know, that's an extreme example, but it became indicative for me of a cultural shift toward a kind of reductionist communication, you could call it. Sherry Turkle, professor over at MIT, she talks a lot about how digital natives have become much more comfortable with texting than with voice-to-voice conversations. I think most parents who have teenage children...
We know this.
Yeah, I'll tell you, yeah. That kids don't use... Phones are not for talking. Phones are for texting. And I think the reason for that is that texting... Well, this is Sherry Turkle's suggestion, is that texting is safe and talking is dangerous because you can't control the conversation, right? It's a lot easier to manage your feelings if you are editing them on your phone screen.
Yeah, well, I find that interesting because you lose so much context from a tone of voice, nonverbal cues, and there's far more ambiguity in written text depending on the skill of your writing.
No, absolutely. I'd argue that more than half of the information that we get from a voice conversation is not the literal words themselves, but it's the way somebody breathes, it's the way that they enunciate, it's the way they make eye contact with you. There's so much data streaming at you when you have a face-to-face conversation with somebody. And being uncomfortable with that kind of interaction maybe one more sign of a culture addicted to online distraction and online processing of their emotions.
Does this portend bad signals for human relations if we're uncomfortable face to face, if we're uncomfortable voice to voice, rather than in a written form? I wonder about that with kids today.
Yeah. I mean, I choose to be as optimistic as possible about these things. So my thinking is that what we need to do is bring media studies, like critical studies in how technology works, into our high schools and even our elementary schools. I think all those language arts programs we have, alongside teaching children Shakespeare and poetry, And grammar, we do need to also teach them how technology changes what you say and how it changes what you see. Until we get that done, I think we'll be failing our children to a certain degree.
One of the things I sort of came away from this book with, I just come back from 2 weeks of vacation and a big long road trip, and you know, I found myself using my portable phone instead of a map, which I can read really well. I can get around with a map, but I was using my phone instead. I was answering emails on the trip. So I was really working while I was on vacation. I was using a variety of online tools to find a place to eat instead of asking somebody. And these are all themes that are touched on in this book that we're kind of losing some essential skills. And one of the things I was really struck by is you talked about a teacher that made you memorize the opening of Paradise Lost. You went back to him and said, you know, do kids have trouble memorizing Paradise Lost? And he said, well, yeah, they're very much afraid that they can't memorize this.
Yeah. And that's a perfect example of the way that the brain works in culture, right? The brain that digital natives have been given is not fundamentally different from the brains that our ancestors had 10,000 years ago. They are as capable of memorizing the first 50 lines of Paradise Lost as anybody, except that every day of living in a culture, your brain is conditioned one way or another. So we do have to, like that professor, Dr. Danielson, he has to train their brains to memorize poetry. And it's sort of like somebody running a marathon, not realizing that they can run the marathon until after they've trained. It seems impossible before they do it. But I think that's that example, that we don't have to become passive victims of our technologies, that our brains can be, like any muscle, can be trained so that we have this healthy media diet where we go online when we want to, when we need to, but we also know the value of absence and solitude and detaching, and we transit between those two worlds.
My guest today is Michael Harris, a journalist and contributing editor at Western Living and Vancouver Magazines. His book is titled The End of Absence, Reclaiming What We've Lost in a World of Constant Connection. It's published by Current. It's a fascinating look at how the internet age has changed us and how we're changed by the fact that we're constantly wired in and the changes it's making to our body physically, brain-wise, as well as how we relate to one another. It's a very interesting book, and he's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. I was struck by that whole idea of loss of memory, the idea that we're forming new neural connections by some things that we don't have to do anymore, like prior to a smartphone, memorizing telephone numbers. That was sort of, you know, you need to know your circle of people. You need to memorize their telephone numbers. A lot of things that are, you can say, well, we really don't need to do this because we have this phone. But is there something we're losing brain plasticity-wise by not doing those sorts of activities?
Well, first of all, there's this word memory that we use when we talk about our computers, right? Mm-hmm. Say I'm offloading it to my computer's memory, or my computer's memory can hold that for us. And I think it's a mistake using that word, memory, because what computers are actually very good at is recall. They will go into a filing cabinet and pull out the exact document as it was and return it to you. It's recall. Human memory is actually a very different, much messier operation. And I think we should keep that word distinct, because when you remember something, there's a process called reconsolidation, where the memory comes forward out of a long-term memory into working memory, and the memory is changed every time you remember it. And yes, human memories are fallible, but that's actually part of what makes them so wonderful. We slowly curate our memories, and we craft our memories and edit and curate them so that we build a story of our own lives. We get this rich interior life that's almost like a painting of who we were. And so slowly, over the course of a life, when you invest in these memories, you build a painting of yourself. You build a sense of yourself. And that doesn't happen as much if you're constantly allowing a computer to hold on to those memories for you.
The name of the book, The End of Absence, suggests that absence is something worth reclaiming. In the second half of the book, you talk about trying to disengage somewhat at times. Mm. That sounds like it was a difficult task. How do we disengage? You quote a professor who specializes on the media's effect on youthful brains. He's studying this for a living. And he admits that when he's writing a paper, he can't go 5 minutes without checking his email.
Yeah. No, absolutely. Knowing about these things doesn't necessarily keep you from becoming an addict yourself. In fact, I mean, people like myself who are drawn to writing about it, often it's because we feel especially addicted to these technologies. In order to really try and give myself a digital detox, I took 30 days offline, so no internet and no cell phone. This was 1 year ago this month, so I call it my analog August.
Yes. How did that go?
Well, for the first 2 weeks, I would say I was going through withdrawal symptoms. I was actually dreaming of text messages at one point and dreaming of emails. So it was really, I mean, I'm not a smoker, but I imagine it was a sort of similar feeling of panic when I couldn't have that thing I was addicted to. And, you know, by the end of it, it's not as though after a month offline, your brain hasn't ticked over. So suddenly you're cured and the internet doesn't have an effect on you. It's just that when you walk away from something for a while, you become more able to see what that thing really was. You become more cognizant of the ways that you are addicted, and you start making little decisions like, I'm going for a walk in the park. I don't need to bring my phone with me. Or I don't need to check the email 20 times a day. Maybe I only need to check it 3 or 4 times a day. The world doesn't fall apart, it turns out, when you pull back on that level of connection just a little bit and give yourself more time to develop that rich interior life.
Now, that's something I've fallen into the habit of, is checking email constantly. And this book has sort of reminded me, and you have an expert who says, look, do it 2 or 3 times a day. It's not all that great an efficient way to communicate anyway. Check it 2 or 3 times a day, and that's it. Mm-hmm. Now, have you taken that to heart yourself?
Yeah. I mean, I'd say, you know, everything in moderation, including moderation. So I have a book that just came out, right? So I'll have an exciting day where there's a lot of stuff going on online that's related to me or related to the book. So sure, I'll indulge in checking online more often. But it's all about then noticing what I'm doing there and then pulling back and saying, okay, for the weekend, I only need to check my email once a day. Or I can leave my phone at home and have that great dinner out with friends and not be peeking at it every time I go to the washroom or something. I'm not a saint in any way. I still fall into little rabbit holes of connectivity that I have to dig myself out of. But I feel like I've become, over the course of writing this book, more awake to those addictions that I have.
I was really struck by something you sort of realized in Analog August, which was at the beginning, when your partner is still using digital media,
yep.
You know, all this sort of non-connected time while he's interacting with technology and you're not.
Yeah.
And then once it was over, it was the exact opposite. You're catching up on a month's worth of emails.
I mean,
And it's just like, he's nowhere.
Yeah. Well, that's what happened, right? Is for about a month, I was the best boyfriend in the world because, you know, I was just sitting around waiting to connect with him, basically. I was so hungry for social grooming that I would normally get online that I was paying rapt attention to him anytime he spoke. And I was always, you know... Ready and willing to hang out with him and chat with him. After my month was over, I went back online and I had those hundreds of emails in my inbox. And, you know, it was like, well, again, like somebody who tried to quit smoking for a month and then lit up that one cigarette, I really did dive into this black hole of my laptop and became the worst boyfriend in the world very quickly.
The name of the book is The End of Absence, Reclaiming What We've Lost in a World of Constant Connection. It's published by Current. My guest is Michael Harris, a journalist and contributing editor at Western Living and Vancouver Magazine. And this book is really interesting because it gives you lots of things to think about how we're adapting and being changed by the digital revolution. So how can we reclaim some moments of absence? Give us maybe a few suggestions.
Well, as you mentioned before, my publisher, Current, has put forward this Analog August website. So it's just www.analogaugust.com, where we're encouraging people to take a weekend off sometime this month from the internet. And actually, if you do so, then Penguin will send you a Penguin Classic for free, which you can read on your time off, I guess. So that digital detox thing is a good way to wake yourself up a little bit. What else can we do? I mean, I think one of the things, if you're in a family, is modeling behavior for your children becomes key, because if kids see you using a cell phone at the table, they're going to then think that's okay, and they're going to do it twice as much. And when you're in a small social group, what I find is that when one person becomes distracted by their phone, it becomes an invitation for other people to become distracted. So there's a kind of compound effect. So setting some rules, like at the dinner table or maybe in the evenings, of little moments in the day where you're free from your phones, I think that little bit of space can actually have a big effect for families.
You know, etiquette experts are telling us these sorts of things that we should know instinctively, but I don't think there's a really cure, you know, sort of well-defined notion of digital media etiquette.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's so new, right? We're sort of having to make it up as we go along, I guess. But all etiquette comes down to making other people feel comfortable and showing that you respect and care about each other. I think that's what all those rules, when you boil them down, that's what they were designed for helping us be good social creatures. And so we should be able to, as you say, instinctively figure it out. If I'm staring at a phone while somebody's talking to me, then that's not really showing much respect, right? So I think even though the rules themselves haven't been written down, we can translate the older rules that we have.
Yeah. Well, it's a really interesting book, The End of Absence. Michael Harris, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Michael Harris is a journalist and the author of The End of Absence, Reclaiming What We've Lost in a World of Constant Connection. It's published by Current. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.